told you at the beginning of the class we were going to go through the second and third centuries of the development of Christianity, and we're now, we'll be halfway through here after this first hour, and we're not yet through half of the New Testament. But we have to set the stage to understand what happened in that second and third centuries. Last time we got through up, Jesus starts the church, and it starts to spread, and lots of people begin to come into the church. They're all Jews at the beginning, or proselytes. We'll talk about that a little bit more. And then they come across the Samaritans. And you have, for the first time, large numbers of Gentiles coming into the church. But with them is this Simon Magus, this Simon the Magician. And he is one of the first of a new group of thinking that's beginning to pop up all over the empire called Gnosticism. Now, Gnosticism would be considered Christian, but actually Gnosticism, and we'll talk a little bit more about that today too, isn't Christian. It just mixes all kinds of things together. It's been called the hamburger helper of religion. It just mixes things together. And it becomes a very complex religion, that is almost impossible to understand. I mean, there are scholars that just study Gnosticism today, and they all say the same thing. I'm taking a college class right now on Gnosticism, and it's like, it's so complex, we don't know what it means. I can't tell you what it all means, but I can tell you the essential part of it that affected the growth of, or the formation of early Christianity. Yeah.
Are there people who actively support Gnosticism
yes.
today? Okay.
Well, once again, it's the hamburger helper.
I just meant like directly, like openly. So
there's a website I found years ago where it was supposed to be the Gnostic website, those who have discovered the true Gnosis. Okay. So yes, there are a few people who claim to be true Gnostics. Most people like elements of Gnosticism. There's been Christians that have written that we need to explore whole books. There's one in the 70s written by a feminist that we need to go through and explore Gnosticism because it helps us understand the role of women in Christianity better. Although she's changed some of her opinions now because as she has studied Gnosticism more and more, she realized she came to some wrong conclusions about how, because it is so complex. So yes, there are a few people who claim to be Gnostics, but you will find Gnosticism in Hinduism. You'll find it in elements of Christianity. There's even elements of Gnosticism in some Jewish groups, not in the main body, but in some Jewish groups. So here we are. We're up to the point where Paul goes out. And Paul's going to go out and to spread the gospel all over the Roman Empire. I'm amazed that God sends out one man to do this enormous work. Other people were sent out, but he did. And setting up churches all over the Roman Empire is amazing. Now, I will say one thing about the early churches. Outside of Judea and in the Middle East, the churches weren't very big. Most of them were in people's houses. We know that Ephesus had a big church because they had to rent a hall. We know Antioch had a big church in Antioch, Syria. So some of these churches were very small. Some of them were quite large. Corinth seemed to have a very large church. When I say large, I don't mean like a mega church, like thousands of people. We're talking about maybe a few hundred people. So when we think about the churches at this point, they're small. Christianity for 300 years is always a little minority inside the Roman Empire. For hundreds of years, it's a small minority, and many times it's persecuted. And understand, when the Romans persecuted Christians, they didn't differentiate between Christians. If you were a Sabbath-keeping Christian, a Sunday-keeping Christian. If you were a Gnostic who claimed to be a Christian, they didn't care. They persecuted all of them. Okay, so Christians get all lumped together. Sort of like today, if you said, well, are you a Christian? Well, yes. Well, are you a Jehovah's Witness, a Mormon? Are you a Catholic? Are you a Lutheran? Are you a Methodist? And they all believe different things. The Methodist Church right now is going through a major split because the original Methodists were very strict in their viewpoint of the Scripture, very strict. And now in the United States, they have a lot of women pastors. they openly support homosexual pastors, and especially a lot of lesbian pastors. And the old-time Methodists are saying, we won't take this. And they're kicking him out of the church. So they were going to pass a whole new set of teachings that would say that we accept lesbian pastors. And the only reason it didn't pass was all the ministers from Africa that are Methodists, when their whole group got together, voted against it. So now they're trying to drive the African church out of the Methodists, and they're the ones who are actually the old Methodists. They're the ones who are the true men. And the Methodist church back years ago had a lot of truth in it. Now it has almost none. And they're trying to drive out the ones. So you will eventually have a Methodist church in Africa that will have nothing to do with the Methodist church in the United States. So Christianity today is in this constant flux of change and argument and all these things going on. We're going to see that that's what happened in the second century. But we're also going to see that they had lots of problems in the first century, as you know, as you've been going through, especially the epistles of Paul. Why did Christianity work? Why did it spread? It makes no sense that a Jewish rabbi, I mean, let's look at it from a historical viewpoint, a Jewish rabbi with 12 guys and a few women following him, and at the end of his 3.5 year ministry, it says he has 120 people. That's it. 3.5 years, he has 120 followers. And within 30 years after his death, the Romans are trying to wipe them out because they become a threat to the empire. How in the world did that happen? I mean, there's no Wi-Fi. There's no computers. There's no phones. There's no electric. There's no way to even communicate except somebody walks up to you and talks to you. How in the world did this happen? Well, there's a number of things that we've already covered that we start to see laid a groundwork for the expansion of Christianity. And one, by the way, was this remarkable world of the Roman Empire where all religions were openly discussed. I mean, everybody had a religion and everybody talked about religion. No, not everybody had a religion. Everybody had multiple religions. I mean, the Romans would talk about the gods. And you can say, well, what gods do you worship? Well, I worship Sybil. Oh, I've heard of Sybil. Tell me about Sybil. I'm a Zeus man myself. But they all worship the gods, and they tried to make sure they appeased all gods. You know, you don't want to make any god mad. And some gods were just more powerful than other gods. And what basically the Romans did, by the way, is they took all the Greek gods and made them their gods. They're our gods. These are good gods, so we take them. So you see the Greek influence too, but they just take their gods and make them their gods. So you have this open religious world, you know, where all this stuff's going on and everybody is supposed to be just tolerant. And the most intolerant religion on the face of the earth are the Jews. All you people, you believe in gods that don't exist, or you believe in demons. You're worshiping demons. Even Paul said that. You people worship demons. Wait, I worship Zeus. I worship Apollo. I don't worship a demon. Demons are bad. They believed in demons too. Okay? Demons were bad. Angels are bad gods. And so how can you say that? So you had this religious debate going on, so people will listen to Paul. Think about how Paul goes into the Areopagus, which is in Athens, center of Greek culture. Athens, of course, in Greece, Alexandria and Egypt, the two centers of Greek culture. And he doesn't quote once from the Bible because they would have had no knowledge of the Hebrew Scriptures. What he quotes is some passage out of a Greek poet that basically is saying, you know, Zeus is a great god, but there's something above Zeus. I've read the poem, and once again, I don't understand all of it. And he's telling you, I'm telling you about the unknown God. Now remember Plato said, there's the one, right? That made all the other gods, the one. And when he says, I'm here to tell you about the unknown God, it's like, oh, someone that can help us know the unknown God. Plus, there's another thing that happened in Athens, is that they'd had a plague come through. And once again, what they did was they said, we've made some God mad. So they went to every temple in Athens and did a sacrifice, the leaders of the city, to every single god and goddess that they knew. And then they said, what if we're missing somebody? So they built, they created an altar to the unknown god. So the unknown god was someone important to them. We don't know who he is, but we must have made him mad because we have this plague and those comes from the gods. You have to understand the superstition of paganism. In paganism, you are controlled by the gods. And since the stars are living beings and the sun and the moon are living beings, you got to study them. That's why they studied astrology, because that tells you what to do. You ever see in the newspaper today? Where, yeah, well, newspapers aren't that common anymore. I haven't seen a newspaper in a long time, but it used to be in newspapers had astrology charts. And people every day, when I was a kid, people would go look up their astrology. I didn't, but you know, I forget what my sign was. Someone told me what my sign was one time. And you'd go look it up and it'd tell you what your day is going to be like. And I knew people that actually believed that. They were Christians, but they were pagans. They didn't know they were pagans. They believed that somehow the stars controlled their destiny. Well, if you lived in the first century and you went any place in the Roman Empire, there's one thing that everybody agreed on, no matter what religion they were, except the Jews. Oh, the stars control your destiny. Those are gods. Those are living things up there. And so you better study the stars. And so they mapped out the stars. You know, when we look at astronomy, they had sophisticated astronomy. But it wasn't so they could have scientific knowledge. It was so they could figure out how the gods are manipulating their lives. I mean, you wouldn't make a wise decision. And in the Roman army did this all the time. Before they made an attack, they brought in certain animals, gutted them, and had the priests look at their livers. If the liver had a certain shape, oh, don't attack today, something bad's going to happen. If it had like cancer on it, oh no, retreat. I mean, they studied the liver, and the liver would tell them what to do. Because the liver, some god would be, they would sacrifice to some god and look at the liver. Paganism is, we do certain pagan things in our society, we don't know it, but it's hard for us to live in that world. Christianity is born in an absolute pagan world. There's Judaism and there's paganism, and paganism is 1,000 different religions. But they all get along. They all get along because, well, they all believe in each other's gods. Doesn't mean there's not religious wars. The religious war is to show that my God is better than your God. Remember, there's one place in Judges where Israel was invaded, and I think it was the Midianites. They invaded, and they said, don't go fight them in the hills, because the God of Israel is the God of the hills, and we'll lose there. And the reason why is every time they went into the hills, the Israelites would do a guerrilla warfare, and they would lose. So in their mind, the God of Israel has power in the hills, but you know what? We stay in the valleys, we win. Now, the reason they stayed in the valleys and won is because they had chariots. And chariots don't do well in hills. But in their mind, their God is the God of the hills. Don't fight, just drive them in the hills and leave them alone. Just get them in the valleys where our God will defeat them. Now, eventually, God of Israel did defeat them by having the wheels come off their chariots and they get stuck in the mud. Okay, so he did defeat them. But in their mind, he couldn't defeat them in the valleys. He was the God of the hills. This is paganism. And the Roman Empire is pure paganism. But why did Christianity spread in this? Well, number of reasons. One of the reasons is roads. The Romans built, they estimate, at least 50,000 miles of roads. Now you have to understand, until the Roman, even during the Persian Empire, they had a hard time connecting their people. There weren't real good roads. Dirt roads. And they got washed out and everything. So it was hard to keep an empire together. The Greeks didn't even try. The Romans, though, said, you know what? We need to build roads that will last. They still exist today. And they're an exact width. And the reason they're an exact width, because there's another reason for the roads, is that's how wide it is for chariots and wagons and the way the legions marched, so many, you know, abreast with each other. That was exactly how wide it took for a legion to march. So you could take a legion where it might take in the past 3 months to get a legion someplace, and you could get them there in 4 weeks. Now, you have to understand, in the ancient world, that's so fast, people couldn't believe it. You know, there's a problem, and 4 weeks later, there's three legions. There's 15,000 men at your front door. The speed was unbelievable to them. These roads are built for commerce. They're built to connect the empire, and they're built so they can get their army any place in the world they need to. And so they still exist today. So that's one of the reasons why Paul could get to the empire. He could get, and plus, because of the Roman navy always fighting the pirates, you had a fairly good chance of getting across the Mediterranean in ships, although storms tended to wreck a lot of ships. And if you read Acts, that's exactly what happened to Paul. He gets shipwrecked a couple of times. But at least they could get across because the Roman navy was out there fighting the pirates for them. And the Roman navy kept these lines open because they wanted everybody to make money. Remember, this is the ultimate capitalistic society. There are no regulations on anything except you pay your taxes. You give us our taxes, we're happy. Get as rich as you want to be. And you could do it dishonestly. You could do it through slaves. You can do however you want. Just pay your taxes. So this road system is very important. They allowed religious freedom as long as it didn't interfere with them. In fact, they asked all religions to sacrifice to their gods for the emperor. So every god will bless the emperor. You have the Greek language. Remember we talked about the Greek language, how it just sort of gets spread throughout the empire. So that becomes the language of commerce and the language of education. And this allows a communication level that had never existed since before the Tower of Babel. There had never been this level of communication available on widespread numbers of people since the Tower of Babel. Because many people spoke more than one language. And Greek was the common thing that could glue them together. You also have the Septuagint. I mentioned that before. Around 250 BC, a group of Jewish scholars decided, and they don't know, they think there's 70 to 72 of them. They decided, you know, they needed to take the Hebrew Bible and turn it into Greek because they needed it in all the synagogues. Synagogues needed scriptures, and people didn't know Hebrew in most places except the rabbi. So for people to understand, they needed to have a Greek version of the Bible. It's called the Septuagint. This is really hard because in Greek, Septuagint means 70. And there were 70 guys that worked on it. About. Okay, so it's called the Septuagint. That's why some of you will have margins in your Bible, and there'll be little numbers. You ever look at those? And every once in a while, you will see something in the New Testament, and then you'll see a number, and you look, and it says LXX. You ever see that before? You look, every once in a while, you'll see that if you have a margin, and it'll say LXX. LXX is what in Roman numerals? Anybody know Roman numerals? 70. That means that quote is from the Septuagint. This is why in the New Testament, you're going to occasionally find a quote of the Old Testament. Now, the Old Testament that we have is translated from what is called the Masoretic text. It is the official Jewish Hebrew text. And you can take that quote and you go back and you read it and you'll think, boy, they misquoted that. Or something happened. It's not the same. It has the same meaning, but it's just different. That's because the New Testament, sometimes the writers are not quoting the Hebrew. They're quoting the Greek. So you're getting a translation of a translation into English. You're getting a third generation translation. And so it's slightly different. That doesn't mean it's wrong. It means you have to recognize, there's one place, there's one quote in the New Testament where it quotes the Old Testament as saying, and the Messiah will go to the Gentiles. You go back and look, I think it's in Isaiah, and it actually says in the Masoretic text, and the Messiah will go to the islands, which means all over the place, right? So when they translated that into Greek, it was like, to the islands. And the Hebrew language is very poetic. Okay? And now they go to the nations, they go to the nations, they go to the Gentiles, they not say to the islands. So that's what they wrote, which makes sense in Greek. So we like, actually, it makes more sense in English, unless you understand the poetic aspects of Hebrew. So that's why you'll see this LXX in your Bible sometimes. But the Septuagint allowed Paul to go to places and say, open the scroll, let's read it. And he didn't have to read it in Hebrew, although he could read it in Greek, and the people could understand. The synagogue, remember we talked about the synagogue. When you go through the book of Acts, what's very interesting, where did Paul go to every city he went to? He goes, except Athens, where did he go? Anybody? He's sent to the Gentiles. And notice he never starts with the Gentiles except in Athens. He always starts with the synagogue. Why? Well, he can go to the synagogue and there are scrolls and there are people who will listen to him. And the people who know the scrolls are going to be Jews and they're going to say, Jesus is the Messiah. Jesus is the Messiah. But there's two other things here that is many times missed in the understanding of how the Christianity grew. And as you go through the book of Acts, I want you to start noticing this. So where are you in the book of Acts? You're right. You're partly through the book of Acts now, right? 19. So you've been through Simon. You're up to where Paul goes to Ephesus and finds the 12 people that have a church but no Holy Spirit. Okay. Hey, pardon? Okay. So you have some background. And you, if you go back and look, and then you look at what's going to happen, every place he goes to the synagogue. And it's amazing. He'll preach, and it'll say, and the next Sabbath, almost all the Gentiles came. Well, how did they know what he was talking about? In the Jewish world, there's two kinds, at that time, two kinds of non-Jews that had become part of Israel. And you'll see these terms used in the New Testament. Proselytes. A proselyte was someone who converted to being a Jew. They were circumcised. They usually went through some kind of baptism ritual. And they did a sacrifice if they could get to Jerusalem. And they literally became a Jew. I am now a Jew. Which was okay in the Jewish religion. You know, if you look at, it's interesting, if you even go back to the Old Testament, they are commanded in the law, in the Torah, to not marry Moabites, because the Moabites had really mistreated the Israelites for hundreds of years. Anyone know of a story where someone married a Moabite? Ruth was a Moabite, and she is part of the lineage of Jesus. So why are they commanded not to marry Moabites? And here we have this whole story of this woman who is a Moabite, gets married to Boaz in one of the great love stories of the whole. I mean, it's this incredible love story. You know, this romantic love story. Marries this guy who is an Israelite, and she becomes part of the lineage of Jesus. Because she wasn't considered a Moabite anymore. She had converted to the worship of Yahweh. She was now an Israelite. Even though she wasn't physically an Israelite. So it was the same thing with the proselytes. Oh, you're a proselyte. You can come in. Now, they were given, as far as we know in the first century, many of the same, in other words, they were considered a full citizen. They were considered a full citizen. I don't know, and I haven't been able to find out, in the Jewish synagogue, they separated the men, the women. Remember, one of the reasons for separating the men and women is to build a hedge around the wall. If the women are separated, the men and women can't be looking at each other. There can't be any lustful thoughts going on because they're separated. Okay? So we're protecting the Sabbath. And the Gentiles had to sit in another place because they weren't really Jews. And I think the proselytes got to sort of sit with the Jews. But there weren't that many proselytes. There weren't a lot of men that were willing to say, hey, yeah, I'm 30, I'll get circumcised. There just wasn't a lot of men willing to do that. But they wanted to keep the Sabbath, and they wanted to obey God, and they wanted to do the holy days. They gave up paganism. So they became known as God-fearers. In Acts, you have Peter go to Cornelius, a Roman soldier, who is a God-fearer. And he builds a synagogue. But he can't go sit with the Jews that he built the synagogue for. He can only go sit in this. And the temple itself in Jerusalem, the Gentiles could not go past a certain wall. They have found the inscriptions. We know Josephus tells us what they say. They've actually found two of them. And it says, anybody that goes past this wall that's not a Jew will die. And it's in Aramaic, Hebrew, and Greek. You go past this wall, you die. You're not allowed to come in here unless you're a Jew. That's why they rioted against Paul. When you get to where Paul goes back to Jerusalem, there's a riot against him because they say he's brought a Gentile into past the wall. Okay. Well, even the synagogue, the Gentiles had to sit other places, but they were considered God-fearers. Cornelius says to Peter, look, you can't even come into my house. I'm not a Jew, but I am a God-fearer, and I want to be baptized. I now accept Jesus as the Messiah, and I want to be baptized. But you know, don't come into my house. I'm not really clean. This division between Jew and Gentile is a major problem in the first century. You're going to see it over and over and over again be a major problem. And we're going to find it have an effect in the second century. So we have the proselytes and God-fearers. Remember who they are. So what happens in the first century is all over the empire, Gentiles, Greeks, Romans, Spaniards, Ethiopians. We know Ethiopians because they're mentioned in the Bible. Arabs. Some people start to convert to Judaism. They either become proselytes or God-fearers. Now, they're not in huge numbers, not millions of them, but there's enough that the Romans start noticing it. And Tacitus, we keep going back to Tacitus, is one of our original sources. He writes this, proselytes to Jewry adopt the same practices. Now, in this context, he was talking about intermarriage and accepting circumcision. And he says, they're just weird. See, the Romans didn't care what your religion was when you intermarried each other because everybody accepted everybody else's religion. But the Jews were like, nope, if you don't believe in our God as the only God, we won't marry you. Plus, the circumcision thing, the Greeks considered circumcision to be mutilation. They considered it to be barbaric. And the Romans accepted the same idea. Only barbarians would take the, because they saw the body as beautiful. The body is this beautiful creation. And why? To mutilate the body was considered one of the most immoral things you could do. So circumcision was an issue of morality. Circumcision was a barbaric god that committed this horrible crime against the human body. And so he says, first of all, any Gentile, well, he wouldn't call them Gentile, anybody that's not Jew, marries into their family and converts, well, then they can't marry the rest of us. And they caused their children to be circumcised. And the very first lesson they learn, remember, this is from a Roman viewpoint, is to despise the gods. Yeah, because they're against idolatry. Shed all feelings of patriotism. You know, they're not loyal to the Roman Empire anymore. These aren't patriot people. They revolt. They're not people you can trust. And consider parents, children, and brothers as readily expendable. In other words, if you're a pagan and I'm now a Jew, sorry, I'm not coming to your temples. I'm not coming to your celebrations. Sort of like today, if someone comes into what we believe and you say, I'm not going to keep Christmas and Easter, your family says, well, we're expendable. What do you mean you're not going to keep Easter and Christmas? Just do it because it's fun. Nope, it's a wrong religious... This ceremony. We're not going to do it. This is what they were experiencing. And this is what the Romans are looking at the Jews. Now, they're going to say the same thing about the Christians. So now, Paul begins to plant all kinds of churches all over this Roman Empire. We don't know if he ever got into Spain. He talks about going there, but we know he and others, he's not the only one, all through Italy, all through, let's see what's over here. Because you've got churches all over Jerusalem, all up through this area, all through Asia Minor, which is Turkey, all through Greece. Greece had lots of churches, and Italy. This area really spread. We know churches ended up over here in North Africa too. Egypt and North Africa. So they're spreading churches all over the place. We don't know of any in Germania, up in here. They have some in Gaul, which is France, but that's in the second century. And there are churches in the second century over here in Spain. Any questions about what we've covered this morning so far? Okay, this is basically, once again, information you've covered a lot of. We're just putting the pieces together. Okay. Paul now starts to spread all over the Roman Empire, these churches. And they begin to struggle right away. New people are coming in. I mean, and they're bringing new ideas with them. Plus, even the Jews are struggling. You'll see at the very beginning in the book of Acts, in Galatians, which is Paul's first letter he ever wrote, is, no, we can't force these Gentiles to be circumcised. And there were people who left the church over it. There were fragmentations in the church. Of course they have to be circumcised. And they could build the argument. God commanded Abraham to circumcise. God commanded Moses. When Moses didn't circumcise his own sons, God was going to kill his sons. That's how important it is. That is the sign that you are the people of God. And if you're not circumcised, you don't have a covenant with God. So by commanding these Gentiles, not that they didn't have to be circumcised, you were cutting them off from God. They couldn't have a full relationship with God. That's how they saw it. They believed in Jesus Christ as the Messiah. They believed he was the Son of God. That wasn't the issue. The issue was, and I could line up every scripture they used to argue. And Paul can line up all the scriptures starting in Deuteronomy that says, there will come a time when I will not circumcise you in the flesh, but I will circumcise you in the heart. But wait a minute, this is the time now. There's still circumcision. Circumcision now, and according to Paul, is baptism. By the way, you still have to be circumcised, men and women. But circumcision is of the heart, and it is to be baptized. Okay? Yeah.
So if these proselytes and God-fearers were probably a phenomenon that's happening before Christ,
yes,
or even, you know, as Christ is growing up, like this was something that wasn't just after Christ.
Right.
Then Christ hadn't been sacrificed yet, so circumcision still would have been
okay.
They would have been under that old covenant. So then is it really that crazy for the Jews at the time to expect that of them?
Okay, good question. If you lived in Judea, you would expect them to be circumcised. Remember, if the question, you know, let's look at all over the Roman Empire, these synagogues. If you have a synagogue and you have 30 Jews in your synagogue and you have 30 new people that have come in and they're Gentiles and they refuse circumcision, then you still accept them, but they're second-class citizens. Actually, that's happening in Judea because that's what happened with Cornelius. He now is considered a God-fearer. He has now received salvation, but he's a second-class Jew. He has to sit in a different place than everybody else. He can't participate in certain things because he's not circumcised. So the Jews accepted this, but they were inferior. Okay, there was like a class system here that forms. So when Paul comes around and says this, he now enters into a Jewish fight. Because there's the Pharisees are saying, and the Essenes are saying, no, you have to be circumcised. You see what I mean? Now, there's others that are considered more liberal in Judaism saying, no, you can't make them to be circumcised. They have to keep the Sabbath and stop worshiping idols and, you know, stop doing these things, and that's enough for God. So what does the early New Testament church argue in Acts 15? Okay. When they come in, let's just give them, here's the things they start with. Think about it. Stop eating meat offered to idols. Stop all this immorality. And that isn't all they had to do. It was the list. Circumcision is not on the list. So the church is actually taking, and there's this whole section of Jews that say, ah, this Jesus sect of Judaism, they've got it right. There's other Jewish people that are coming into the church saying, oh, our church has become liberal because we're not forcing them. So there's this fight going on inside Christianity because it's going on inside Judaism. But all over the empire, it's more common to accept proselytes because they're starting to be attracted to this idea of this one God. Because paganism doesn't work. Does that answer your question?
my point, I guess, is more like we believe that the new covenant started with Jesus Christ's death and resurrection. Like right. That was kind of the ushering in of that, right? He fulfilled the old covenant with that. So if the old covenant includes circumcision, then these people before Jesus' death should have, like, I feel like it's probably a little benevolent of the Jews at the time to say, well, you can even come into church when they were so strict about this old covenant.
Except that there was a belief in among Jews that the covenant was made specifically with them. And others got sort of the privilege of hanging on to it, but that it was special to them. There are Jews today who resent us for keeping the Sabbath. That's our day. God will accept you as a Gentile, because we're all considered Gentiles. God will accept you as a Gentile, but don't keep our day. You know, you have some, that's why some Jews claim all you have to do is keep, you know, there were seven laws given to Noah after the flood. There's seven things God says to Noah. You know, don't murder, don't, okay. There are actually Jews that believe, and there's Christians who believe, all Christians have to do, or anybody has to do, is keep those seven laws and they get salvation. That's not what that was about. It wasn't about salvation, but it's what was given. Okay. So that argument is in the Jewish world as it is in the Christian world today. The complexity of this is how do you apply this in the real world? And circumcision became a major issue in Judaism. Christians come along and Paul says, nah, we're under the new covenant. Now he had a more powerful argument. We're under the new covenant, so now it's circumcision of the heart for everybody. But you never see, by the way, the church tell Jews, don't be circumcised. Now, the implication is you don't have to be circumcised, but they never tell them not to because it's too much part of their religion and their relationship with God. So they never tell them not to. They just say, look, you can't force anybody to be circumcised. Josephus, it's interesting. Josephus even mentions at one point that there were some Jews that he became part of his army that the other Jews didn't want to be part of the army because they weren't circumcised. I don't know how they figured out. I don't know, maybe they all jumped into the creek or something, and they said, hey, you guys aren't circumcised. You can't be part of the army. And Josephus said, you know, we can't even really force Jews to be circumcised. That's between them and God. So he's showing a certain strain of Judaism, and that's before Jesus. You see what I mean? So this is a very complicated argument. Like all these arguments, it is actually more clear to us than it was to them because we're looking back through the lens of the New Testament. So, you got lots of God-fearers who are not circumcised, and they're a second-class citizen. Paul comes along and teaches Jesus. They believe in Jesus Christ, and not only that, they find out, wow, we're not a second-class citizen. We're not circumcised, and we can now be part of this new covenant, which is actually better than the old covenant. And so large numbers of God-fearers begin to be attracted to Christianity. And that's what you see in the book of Acts. They run off and tell all their Gentile friends. And the next week, they all show up at the synagogue. Because, look, you can be part of this. Oh, no, I don't want to be part of anything. I'm circumcised. No. It's circumcision of the heart. Come on, he'll explain it to you. And you have something new happening. And then the Jews, lots of Jews in these synagogues start to believe Paul, and they convert. But look how many cases, finally, the Jews who don't believe Paul say, we got to kill this guy. He's bringing all kinds of Gentiles into the synagogue. And so they try to kill him. And these debates are so important. They're part of Judaism and they're part of Christianity. This is going to take a really weird turn in the second century. This is why circumcision is so important in the New Testament. We think, why would they make this so important? Because there's Jews saying, if we're not circumcised, we don't have a covenant with God. And Paul's saying, no, you're circumcised in the heart through baptism and through receiving the Holy Spirit. And some Jews accepted that and some did not. So these are the problems they're dealing with. Here's what you have now influencing the early church. You have secular Judaism. Sectarian Judaism. In other words, Pharisees, Sadducees, Essenes, okay, Zealots, you know, all these people are coming in, and as they come into the Christianity, they're bringing their things with them. And that's why you see arguments. When you read 1 Corinthians, there's hardly anything about circumcision. Why? Just somebody, figure out why in Corinthians, there's almost nothing said about circumcision. It's mainly Gentiles. It's not an issue. They all come in, and circumcision isn't even a thought, except, you know, it's sort of mutilation of the body. So it's not even an issue there. Their issue there is something else. Because as these new people come in, they bring in paganism. So in Corinthians, Paul has to say, stop going to the temples. Stop going to the temple prostitutes. And when he talks about prostitutes there, that's what he's talking about. In Corinth, there were over 1,000 temple prostitutes to the temple of Aphrodite because she was the goddess of love. And it was a seaport. So all the sailors would come in and look for, want to go someplace for a fun night, and they would just go to the temple of Aphrodite where the priest made money off their prostitutes. And they had a booming business. So you have people going to the temple prostitute. You see, why? Because that's what they'd done all their lives. And in Corinth, you were taught as a child, hey, you're going to be a man soon. And when you do, guess what happens? You get to go worship Aphrodite. It was an act of worship. Mom's sending the son off. Oh, it's so exciting. He's going to his first trip to the Aphrodite. The husband, you know, hey, you know, once a month I go to Aphrodite to worship her. Okay. See, this is weird to us. For hundreds of years, this was absolutely normal for people in Corinth. And Paul's now telling them, you can't do that anymore. That's why in Corinth, Paul makes the strange statement, you know, it's probably better you people don't even get married. They were so messed up. Because they asked him the question, should we touch a woman? And his answer is, it's actually better you don't get married, but you know, that's not possible. Human beings are designed to get married. So you're going to have to get married. But you're going to have bad marriages, okay? That's why he says that. So you have paganism coming in, and they're fighting paganism. They never get Corinth cleaned up. You know why? Somewhere around between 100 and 110 AD, there's a letter from a minister sent to Corinth chiding them for all their problems, and they're not quite, it's not a whole lot different than what Paul wrote to them, except they had just kicked out all their ministers. And he says, you can't kick out all your ministers. So Corinth was always a mess. They got better for a while, but they, you know. So you have paganism coming in. You have Greek philosophy coming in more than we might realize, especially in the second century. We'll really cover that today. And then you also have Gnosticism affecting them. And Simon is our first little peek into that this Gnosticism was forming. By the second century, it will be a very complex religion. Yeah, Micah.
So Corinth kind of confuses me a little bit because God specifically said, like, I have people here. And it seems like a big thing in the church, like the early church, was a lot of people coming in, but kind of speculative to how many are actually converted, right? You know, you have thousands being baptized.
Right.
Does that mean every single one is converted, circumcised of the heart?
Right.
Most likely not, but right. Not to judge that. But God's not really one who fails either. People have their own decisions, but if he says, I have people here in Corinth, or he has many people here in Corinth, and Paul stays for that reason, why do we see the exact opposite, where it's like they never got it? Like they did for a brief period, but...
Because some people didn't, but it seems that maybe a majority never did. You've hit on a very important point here. We think everybody in the early church was converted. Simon wasn't converted, and he was baptized into the church. The early church suffered the same problems we have. I baptized people, and realize within 3 days that, you know, yeah, they're still drinking, they're still sleeping around, they're still, and they don't have any really interest in God at all. I baptize people, only find out that they were baptized because their friends were getting baptized, and they didn't want to be left out. And they've admitted to it. I don't even know what repentance means, but my friends were getting baptized, so I got baptized too. Okay. Well, guess what? You fooled me, you don't fool God. You don't fool God. We have the same problem in the early New Testament church. Plus, you have Satan attacking them. Satan's trying to destroy that church. And he's going to pull some people out. There are some converted people that go to the lake of fire because they give up God's Spirit, right? We know that. So you're seeing a battle for the heart and mind of the church going on as all these new people flood in, and they're trying to create a new brand of Judaism, if you will. One that believes the Messiah already came one time. And the majority of Jews are starting to reject them. And pagans are coming in. And you got to try to convert pagans. No, in 2 Corinthians, Paul does say he's impressed that many of them had repented. So there is a repentance on the part of certain people. So the early New Testament church is a struggle because it's very open. And as it's very open, it's just they're getting all kinds of problems coming in with the good. The good and the bad are being mixed together. And they're struggling with it. So there's two things that affect the church in the first century that fragment the church in a dramatic way. The church is going to explode in the last part of the first century. The question was about the Septuagint. The Septuagint wasn't just the Torah. Well, it started with just the Torah. But between that time period of 250 up until the time of Jesus, they actually kept building on it, and they eventually had the entire Old Testament. There is a Greek copy of the New Testament that gets attached to the Septuagint, but it wasn't what we call the Septuagint. The Septuagint was just the Old Testament. Of course, the original New Testament was in Greek, but even those copies you have to look at to try to figure out which ones are more accurate than others. Remember, everything's being copied by hand. And sometimes you can get something that's like, we have 500 copies, and this one says something different. Well, someone made a mistake. Or every once in a while, over hundreds of years of copying, someone would add something. There's an entire verse in 1 John that was added. That's not there in any original manuscript. I say original. We don't have the very first one, do you understand? We have copies of copies of copies. But what's amazing is the copies are remarkably similar. I saw one time some scholar said there's 5,000 differences in the, you know, like 1,000 oldest copies of the New Testament. That's true. The overwhelming majority are spelling differences, which is not meaningless. You know, it doesn't mean that much. So the differences are actually very solvable for the most part. Okay, so there's two things that happen. One, I'm going to talk about Nero. Remember I talked about Suetonius, who was Hadrian's secretary and found all the material about the first 12 Caesars, and he writes a book, a biography of the first 12 Caesars. And he has all kinds of material that you can't find anyplace else. Now, Caligula went insane. Caligula went insane, and I mean, evil insane. And it got so bad, now Caligula was an emperor, that the army killed him. The army literally, the generals got together, overthrew the empire, and killed him. And they didn't know who to put in charge. You know, the Senate could have picked somebody, but the army wanted to keep a certain amount of power. So there was one man that was part of the court there that was related to Caligula. His name was Claudius. And Claudius was considered a buffoon. He had some kind of limp. He was sort of deformed, and he was considered to be a mentally, you know, just a man that wasn't very smart. So they made fun of him all the time. And you know, so he was the big joke of Caligula's court. Well, so the army said, what we'll do is put this man in charge, and that way we can control the emperor because he's just stupid. Well, they put Claudius in charge and found out he wasn't stupid. The reason he had survived in the court so long was by acting stupid. Because Caligula killed anybody he felt was a threat. And old Claudius wasn't a threat because he was so stupid. He actually became a fairly decent emperor. And Nero is part of he's born into the family of Claudius. And finally, Claudius, he's not the direct son of Claudius, but Claudius adopts him. And then, because he marries Nero's mother. And then Nero's mother poisons poor Claudius. And he knows she's doing it. And he's so heartbroken that because he's an old man and she's a younger man, he lets her poison. And he dies. So Nero becomes emperor at age 17. So what Nero does, Nero now decides to have a big party. You're the most wealthiest man in the known world. I mean, he'd have to go to China maybe to find somebody as wealthy. But as far as the known world, they didn't know China was there. You have the most wealthiest man and the most powerful man. Between 60 and 80 million people, he determines who lives, who dies. I mean, this is an enormous amount of power. Seneca, who's one of the great philosophers, Roman philosophers, comes in and teaches him and tries to make him a decent guy. But Nero slowly slides into insanity. He's a very competitive guy, so he likes doing like the Olympic Games and stuff, but he always had the cheat to win, and you know, that wasn't good, to have the emperor cheating. So he decided that what he was really good at was singing. So he made singing an Olympic game, and he won all the time because, well, who's going to sing against the emperor, right? So he decided he wasn't going to expand the empire. He just used the army to protect the empire, and what he was going to do is produce this incredible Roman culture where they were going to have art and sculpture and plays and music and architecture, and he was going to recreate the Roman Empire beyond what Greece had ever done. And he considered himself the greatest intellectual of his day. So singing was a really important part. And he started having concerts. And of course, at first, everyone wanted to come see the emperor sing, right? But I don't think he was that good. And besides, they would go on and on and on. So people would get up and leave, you know, the concert. So he had soldiers kill them as they left. So people didn't leave. In fact, one woman went into labor one time during a concert, and he killed her. So there are cases during his concerts where men had heart attacks. And when they carried them out, they suddenly revived and ran off. So the other way to get out of a concert was to pretend you had a heart attack. Okay, so Nero's absolute, I mean, his arrogance and his selfishness becomes more and more bizarre. He squandered a fortune. In fact, he was bringing the entire Roman Empire into possible bankruptcy because he just spent the money however he wanted. He built huge houses. There's one house he built that, according to Suetonius, was about a mile long. Now, in the Vatican Museum, there's something that usually people don't look at, and I just found fascinating. There is a bathtub from one of his houses. I would guess you could put 12 to 15 people in it. You would have to have a ladder just to get up into it. And, you know, this was one of his bathtubs. He loved, you know, just eating and drinking. He loved just seducing women. He was a bisexual. He committed incest with his mother, and one of his favorite targets was 12-year-old boys. I have to be careful. I can't tell you everything about Nero because it's unbelievable. So he's absolutely just, you know, by his mid-20s, he's just involved in just absolute sexual perversion of anything you can think of. And as the emperor, he could do it. But it just, after a while, wasn't enough kicks. So what he would do for kicks is he would sneak out at night like he wasn't the emperor, and he'd go to the taverns where he'd pick up women at the taverns and get in fights. Except one time, he picked up a man's wife, and the man almost beat him to death. So he learned after that to have a couple Roman soldiers disguised with him, and if he started to lose a fight, they'd go kill the guy for him. They just whip out their swords and hack him to death, and that sort of solved it. So he's, you know, you have a stalker. The most powerful man in the world spends his evenings as a stalker going through, getting drunk, picking up women, and having a couple assassins with him to kill anybody who gets in his face. This is the ruler of the known world. So Nero's is becoming an unpopular emperor, okay? And something happens in 64 AD. Remember I said Rome has these beautiful sections? There's actually 14 precincts to Rome. And they have these beautiful sections. They have these middle-class sections which have really nice houses with these gardens in the middle of the house. So you had your own private little garden, a little park to go to. And you have, I mean, the Forum was amazing. The buildings, even today, when you look at the ruins of them, you're amazed at what those buildings must have been. And you have this army, and you have roads, Oh, by the way, something I didn't mention about roads. Having a road system allowed something to happen that had never happened before. A postal system. Peter could write a letter, and he could go to Laodicea. There was never a good postal system before that. You know, you'd hire somebody to take a letter, and they might get bushwhacked along the way by some robbers. Well, all these roads were also guarded by Roman soldiers, which meant that there was safe passage throughout the empire. But let's go back here. So, Nero, he does decide to kill his mother at one point. He poisons her three times, but she survives. See, she's pretty smart. She knows what's going on. I mean, she killed Claudius. Okay. He builds a... And I'm only using him as an example. Claudius was maybe even worse. I just want to show you what the top of the Roman Empire could be like sometimes. Okay? So he builds a bed. He has to build a bed that weighs hundreds and hundreds of pounds, and there's a canopy on top. And it's built literally so that when she would roll over, once there was a certain stress on the bed, the whole thing would fall on her. And it did. And she survived. Because he didn't want it to be said that he killed his mother. So he built a ship. You know, it was a sailing ship, and you know, there was guys that had to row it out. You know, it was a pretty big ship, and it wasn't some little rowboat. And he built it for as a gift. And they rowed it out into the Mediterranean Sea, and they're not sure what happened. I think there's some guys that were paid to do this, because the ship was built. Some guys went along and knocked out some stakes, and the whole thing literally fell apart. And she swam to shore. Mama just wouldn't go, okay? So finally he hired some assassins and had her killed. Well, now by this point, everybody knows Nero's trying to kill his mom. Okay, they figured it out. So Rome catches fire. One of the dirty precincts. Remember I told you had these nice precincts, and then you have these precincts that are filled with poverty. One of them catches fire. And because the streets are so narrow, because these apartment buildings are just stacked up with like wee little streets in between that sometimes you couldn't even get a wagon down. And because there's so much garbage, there's no indoor plumbing. The indoor plumbing might be for rich people. There's no indoor plumbing. So people just throw, you know, what happens during the night out the windows. So the streets are covered with that. And there's animals all over the place. And it catches fire, one of these precincts. And it burns so fast. And the Roman army is supposed to go in and put out fires. And the Roman army shows up, and they simply loot everything. As people are running and screaming out, they go to the houses and steal everything they have. And the fire spreads to another poverty place, and then to another. And then it starts to spread into middle class sections. And before it's over with, 10 out of the 14 precincts of Rome are either burned or badly damaged. And the Roman army does nothing. So people know the emperor must have told them not to do anything. Now, Nero had been bragging that the next thing he was going to do was build a new Rome. And now, hundreds of thousands of people don't even have a place to live, and hundreds of people died. And most people lost everything. And the Roman army, their protectorate, not only did not help them, they looted them. Every shop was looted, you know, every little business. They went there and just stole whatever they wanted. So they knew the emperor had to be in charge. They knew he didn't send any help. So then the decision was made, you know what must happen? He must have started it. This was his way of burning down Rome to build his new Rome. So he's faced with riots. He's faced with, you know, maybe the army now will try to overthrow him. So he needs somebody to blame. And there is one group of people in Rome that claim that Rome is an evil place. And then someday God is going to bring fire out of heaven and destroy the earth by fire, and then the only people left will be Christians. And so he basically says, the Christians started this. We have Suetonius. He says this. He says, the Christians, men given to a new and wicked superstition, and you see once again how the Romans saw them, were put to death with grievous torments. But he never says they were guilty. He just says Nero goes to kill them. Tacitus is a whole lot more open to what he says. He says, Nero fabricated scapegoats. In other words, everybody knew they didn't do it. And he was a child at the time, but you know, he had seen what had happened. And punished with every refinement the notoriously depraved Christians, as they were popularly called. Their originator, Christ, had been executed in Tiberius' reign by the governor of Judea, Pontius Pilate. But in spite of this temporary setback, the deadly superstition had broken out afresh, not only in Judea, where the mischief had started, but even in Rome. All degraded and shameful practices collect and flourish in the capital. So once again, it's a put-down of Christianity, but it is an admitting that they didn't do this. And what begins now is a Roman persecution of Christians all over the Roman Empire. Some places it's very dramatic, and other places it's not. Some governors would persecute Christians and some wouldn't. But suddenly being a Christian is not a good thing. Where it used to be that, well, you just got another wacky religion. And, you know, since all religions are tolerated, it's okay. But this wasn't a wacky religion anymore. This was a religion that wanted to overthrow the empire by burning Rome to the ground. So that happens in 64 AD. In 66 AD, the Jews in Judea revolt against the Romans. They decide it's time to throw them out of here and get our country back. This is where Josephus is a leader. Remember I told you Josephus ends up being captured by the Romans, goes to Rome, comes back and says, huh, we can't beat these people. They're rebuilding Rome even after the fire, and it's turning into an even grander city. There's still poverty in certain sections, but it's turning into a much grander city even than it was. And so everybody can see the power of Rome. It rebuilds itself. So he comes back, and they lay siege to Jerusalem. And Jerusalem is overcome and destroyed. Jerusalem had been the headquarters for the church. There is no headquarters anymore. In fact, by 70 AD, it appears that all the apostles but one had already died. They'd been killed. There is no central leadership to the church. Acts 15 is a great example of how central leadership solves a problem, right? There's no central leadership. It's just fragmented churches. And they don't have good methods of communication. Right? You have a road system and that's it. There's no electronic connections. There's no way to talk to people on a daily basis outside of your own community. There is something that happens, though, that you need to know that Josephus talks about and Tacitus talks about. So they're people who were, you know, privy to what happened in that siege. They both say that there were miracles that happened. That at one point, you could see an army in the sky. At another point, the Jewish temple, literally, the doors opened, which took lots of men to do it. They were very heavy doors. The doors opened, and there was some kind of shout that came out. And they both claim that. So you have a Jewish and a Roman, although it's possible Tacitus got it from Josephus. We're not sure. But do you have a Jewish and a Roman writing about these events? Eusebius in the 300s, write something that, once again, it's hundreds of years later. So how accurate it is, we don't know, but there are things that make us believe it's probably true. And that is, when that door opened, what they all thought was just a shout that came out was a voice that said, "Remove you hence." Now, in Matthew 24, they were told, Jerusalem's going to be surrounded with armies. Now, we know that's in the future, but let's think of how they looked at it. And there were going to be miracles in the skies. And they heard a voice say, "Remove you hence." And that Christians got together, snuck out through the Jewish lines, snuck out through the Roman lines, and they survived. The Christians survived the destruction of Rome. And they went to a little town named Pella. Now, one reason you think this could be true is for hundreds of years, there are people recording, there are people talking about this little Christian community in Pella that keep the law but believe in Jesus. They're all Jews. So I tend to believe it's true. I believe God took the Christians out of Jerusalem before it fell. And they took them to this little place. And they existed there for generations after generation. But they're no longer an influence on Christianity. I mean, Pella does not become a major place for Christianity. It's a forgotten little backwater that most people don't even know about of the descendants that were taught. You know, these are the children who were taught by Peter and Paul and James. These are the grandchildren and sometimes children of the people who knew Jesus. And they're now just back in this little town, maybe a few hundred of them. That's it. So you see a church now, and think how this church is being persecuted by the Romans, has been thrown out of Judaism, kicked out of the synagogues, and now has no central place at all to go to. The only one left is John, and John ends up where? In prison. And that's why when we get to the end of Revelation, during the siege of Jerusalem, Josephus believes there was over 1 million Jews that died in Jerusalem and the surrounding area, that the Romans killed about 1 million of them. There were thousands of Roman casualties, and the Romans hated casualties. You know. So we're going to make you pay for every Roman soldier that dies. And it was horrendous. They destroyed the temple. The temple is destroyed. For Judaism to exist as the children of Abraham, they have to have a covenant with God. They have to be in the land God promised them. And they have to have a temple and the Torah and a priesthood. They no longer have a priesthood. They no longer have a temple, and they're just fighting to keep the Torah. And now they're being scattered even more. The diaspora is now even, you know, they're being scattered even more than they were. There's still a Jewish presence in Judea, by the way. There's still a Jewish nation there. Judea still exists, but it's very much weakened. So what is the church like? Well, we get to the book of Revelation. And we have the seven churches of Revelation. I mentioned this earlier, but let's think of where we are now in the timeline. The church was born into a Jewish culture, and it was all Jewish. But it was told to go to the world, and so certain aspects of the Old Covenant no longer were applied the same way. You didn't circumcise the flesh, you circumcised the heart. And therefore, Gentiles came into the church in large numbers. You have Jewish sectarianism, you have paganism, you have Greek culture. All these things are now, they're trying to create what Jesus wants them to do by fighting these outside influences at the same time. And just 60-some years after the, you know, about 70 years, 60 to 70 years after Jesus' death, you find a letter to seven churches, all in Asia Minor, all fairly close to each other. And Ephesus is a church that had been very strong. I mean, we have a letter written to Ephesus by Paul. We have a lot in the book of Acts about Ephesus. You can do a whole study on the history of Ephesus. And what the letter says to them about 95 AD is, you've held on to the truth, you've stood up against those who said they were, you know, false teachers, because there are all kinds of false teachers coming into the church, but you've lost something. You've lost your first love. Then we have the Smyrna church. They were a church living in poverty, absolute poverty. And the word there in Greek means, I mean, they're absolutely destitute, and they are being persecuted. They're in one of the places where the local mayor has decided, I'm going to persecute these Christians, and he's persecuting them. Yet, it says they've stayed loyal to God and stayed loyal to their Christian teachings. You have Pergamos and Thyatira, and Pergamos and Thyatira are accused of, you have all kinds of pagan ideas and all kinds of immorality in your church. They're sort of like Corinth. You have Sardis, which John says, you're just a dead church. You all get together, you know. You all come together and you say you worship God and you say you believe in Christ, but you really aren't doing anything. You have Philadelphia, which he says to Philadelphia, You are a church that has it all together, but you don't have much power. You're a little church, but you have it all together. Then he writes to Laodicea, and he says, you're self-righteous, and because of that self-righteousness, you're just lukewarm. You just don't have this desire anymore to follow God. You think you do, but it's just self-righteousness. You think, wow, seven different churches, all sort of close to each other. Now you're starting to see what Christianity has become. Multiply that by hundreds of churches, and they're all developing differently. I think how sad it would be. And I'm thinking, okay, John, he's an old man. And when John was with Jesus, you can imagine what that was like. And then Jesus is resurrected, and you can imagine what that is like. And then the church explodes, and all these people come in, and you're starting churches all over the place, and you have to deal with the problems like, should they be circumcised, and how the Gentiles fit in, and how do we do this, and how do we do that? And you had to do all these things, but there's still an excitement in all this. And then you get through where Peter dies. Paul dies. By the way, Peter and Paul both died somewhere around 68. Probably Simon Magus died somewhere around 68. Also, Nero died around 68. It looks like Nero killed Simon, Peter, and Paul. And then the army, because of what he was doing, the army said, he's as bad as Caligula. And the army overthrew the government again. And he got away, but then they caught up to him and surrounded him. And according to Suetonius, which he interviewed his slave, as he committed suicide by having his slave help him stab himself in the stomach, his last words were, oh, what a great artist here dies. Which probably sounds like what he would do, okay? Oh, the great man, and I have to die, you know, so. And he stabbed himself. But think about all the, you know, Peter's gone, Paul's gone. And think of what it's to be John in 95, and you're writing Revelation from a prison island. And it's like, God, that wasn't supposed to turn out this way. I mean, the Messiah came, Jesus came, and isn't he was supposed to come back? And guess what he gets? The book of Revelation that says, oh no, he's not coming back for a long time. Now that's quite a shock. I'm 95, isn't he coming back soon? Nope. In 70 AD, they probably thought he's coming back. You know, we fled. He got us out of the tribulation into Pella. He's probably coming back. At 64, we're being persecuted by the giant beast power. He's probably coming back. And now the church realizes he's not coming back for a long time. You have that factor too. I can imagine being 95 years old and finding out, no, I just lived my whole life in anticipation of something that's not going to happen in my lifetime. That's going to be a little disappointing. And this is the state of the church at the end of the first century. Not quite the idea like we like to think of the church, is it? It's like, well, this is it? Well, no, this isn't it. The whole point is the church has to continue to go on till Christ comes back. You're part of this story. You're part of this story. And it's sort of comforting in one way to look back and say, oh, those people went through some of the same problems we do. Although, so far, they haven't fed our children to lions yet. I mean, what Nero did to Christians, one thing he did, he had big parties at night to get everybody to celebrate because, you know, people were so upset because over half the city had burnt down. And to light the way, he would turn Christians into giant candles, strap them up and douse them with some kind of flammable and burn them. I can't imagine what the smell was like. This is Nero, folks. And this is what the Christians went through. They took them into, the Colosseum wasn't built yet, but they took them to the Circus Maximus and they fed them to lions. Or they had gladiators come out and hack them to death. And the people cheered. Because they're the people who tried to destroy Rome. They're the arsonists. Oh, that's one thing that early Christians were convicted of. They were all considered arsonists. Yeah, arson's a pretty serious crime, isn't it? By being a Christian, you're an arsonist. It's part of your religion to be an arsonist. We have the proof you burned down Rome. See, from their viewpoint, well, the smart people knew it wasn't true. But this is how Nero controlled the mob. Remember we talked about the mob? He gave them a lie, sold them the lie, and let them have people to kill. And then put on spectacles to kill them. So we're finally to the end of the first century. Now we're going to get into what the class is all about. Second and third centuries. And this is where we are. Any questions or comments about this part so far? Yeah, Micah.
So 1 Peter is believed to be written about 64 AD, which is when Rome burned and persecution probably started. But things, granted, with the roads, they moved fast, but within the same year, does that timeline work, you know, and especially like we believe that Peter was in Babylon, which kind of is confusing me because would they have even called it Babylon at the time? I know some people believe that could be cryptic for Rome itself, which still doesn't make me believe he's a pope, but I'm just saying like that would make it move a lot faster in my mind, you know, if Peter were right there as a hub of strong Christianity. It just feels like 1 year for like Rome to burn, Nero to begin persecution, the word to get to Peter all the way in Babylon, and then Peter to write a responding letter.
I'm not sure he was in Babylon, but that's my opinion. I think he was in Rome. I think he was passing through. He wasn't the Pope there. I think he was passing through. Paul was passing through, and they both got netted in this and killed. And then, of course, when the emperor sent out something, it was like the Pony Express. It got to every place very quickly. Okay, question.
How John like survived all those events beforehand, like how he got to the point where he could like write to the churches. Was he like the same age as Paul and Peter?
Yeah.
So like, how did he like do we have any account of how he survived all those like horrible times?
What we have is Jesus saying to Peter, remember he told Peter, someday they're going to take you someplace you don't want to go. And according to what John writes, because John is writing it, and I like John makes little comments about himself, but it's like, you don't know it's me. But yeah, we do. We know it's you. You know, it's like, so like the apostle that Jesus loved. Well, of course that's you. Okay, but he didn't say me. And then say the apostle that Jesus loved. And it's like Peter goes, well, what about this guy? Well, he doesn't say what about John, but you know who he's pointing at, you know. And he says, because you just told me I'm going to die. You know, because he said they're going to take you someplace where you don't want to go. And in the parenthesis, this way, John writes in, he's telling Peter how he's going to die. So John's getting a little jab at Peter here. And so Peter goes, what about this guy? And his answer is, what is it your business if I keep him alive until I come back? So there seems to have been, no, he's going to live. He's going to survive all this because he's got a work to do beyond you guys. So that's the only key we have. So somehow God kept him alive in all this mess. Now, he was never in Rome. So he never got that. The other persecutions are very, very scattered and unorganized. The one in Rome wasn't. And I believe Peter happened to be in Rome passing through there in the 60s, and that's why he got killed. And that's why Paul got killed, because Paul was in that. Well, Paul was under house arrest. He was already there, you know. So I don't know how he survived, but he did. God kept him from all of it. Any other questions? Isn't it fascinating? John would have been hearing all this, seeing all this, and it's like, God, when's Jesus coming back? When does this stop? These people went through so much, up and down and up and down. And yet they, you know, like John was so faithful. They were all so faithful. Any other questions? Okay. Second century. There are some sources, original sources, I'll tell you about. We're not going to get too far into the second century here, but a little bit. The Ante-Nicene Fathers. Nicaea is a time period where they had a giant church get together to determine certain doctrines. It happened in the 300s. These are writers before that event, so they're called Ante or before Nicene or Nicaea. And you have, I think it's 10 volumes back in the library here. Or you can read them online. You can find them online. The Ante-Nicene Fathers have all kinds of writings from all different, and you start to realize, wow, Christianity in the second and third century became a lot of different ideas, okay, and different teachings. And you have Clement of Rome and Ignatius and Polycarp. Polycarp's going to be very important when we talk about. Barnabas, very important. Justin Martyr, you think, well, how could a guy have a name Martyr? Well, that wasn't his name. It's just that Justin decided that the way to be the best Christian was to die for Christ. So he kept trying to get the Romans to kill him. And so everybody knew him as Justin Martyr. He wants to be martyred. And eventually the Romans obliged him and killed him. You have Irenaeus. We know a lot about Gnostics through Irenaeus. Clement of Alexandria, who's very important. And this is into the third century. Clement of Alexandria, Origen, and Tertullian. The ones that we'll talk about that are in the second century is Clement of Rome, who was a bishop of Rome at the last part of the century, and he died around 101 AD. We have Ignatius of Antioch, Justin Martyr, and Irenaeus. These give us some insight in what was happening in Christianity and the different things that are being taught. Different churches are teaching different things. There's also the Nag Hammadi Library. I mentioned this earlier. In 1945, near the Egyptian town of Nag Hammadi, a shepherd boy was out digging up some, I think it was manure, around some caves for fertilizer, and he found a clay jar. And he took the clay jar back, and unfortunately, his mom said, oh, good, this is good stuff to start a fire with. And she used it to burn. But finally, they started to realize this is important. And they took it to some archaeologist, and they realized these are some of the few original writings we have of the Gnostics. We now understand what Christian Gnosticism was because we have the scrolls. And one thing it does is very interesting. Irenaeus writes all about what Gnostics believe. They now have scrolls of Gnostics, and it's like, oh, Irenaeus was really accurate. So his source, he can be used as a source too because he was very accurate in what he wrote. They continue to work through Gnostic understanding, and they continue to, just in 2006, they finally printed and published the Gospel of Judas, which is a Gnostic writing. We'll talk about that in a little bit too. So they're still continuing to find every once in a while some Gnostic writings. And we have to understand that there was a Christian Gnosticism, and its influence in the second century is enormous. Now, we have an interesting letter that has survived, not an original one, but what's in the copy of a copy of a copy, so we know, and it appears in different books. It appears in Eusebius, and it's Pliny the Younger. Pliny the Elder, I believe was his dad, his uncle or his dad, I don't remember. I think it was his dad. Pliny the Elder died in Mount Vesuvius. When it erupted in 70 AD. And Pliny the Younger is his son. So that's why he's the elder and the younger. And Pliny the Younger becomes a governor of Bithynia. And he knows he's supposed to persecute Christians. Now, this is written somewhere around 112 AD. So now, we have a little piece here that tells us, okay, John's died. What's happening in some places? Because we have no Christian writers, really. I mean, we have Clement and these different people, but they're writing letters. So how do we know what's going on? Well, he writes a letter to Trajan, who was the emperor at the time, about some Christians. He says, well, I finally arrested my first Christians, okay? And here's what he writes. But they declare their guilt or error is simply this. He says, so I have taken them, and what is your crime? Are you arsonist? We've never burnt down anything. Okay, well, are you cannibals? Do you eat somebody once a year at your service? No, we don't do that. Okay, so on a fixed day, he says, this is the only thing they seem to do. On a fixed day, they used to meet before dawn and recite a hymn among themselves to Christ as though he were a god. So far from binding themselves by oath to commit a crime, see, they thought they were a criminal organization. He says, they swear, or in other words, they promise, what their declaration of life is to keep from theft, robbery, adultery, breach of faith, and not to deny any trust money deposited with them when they're called to deliver it. This ceremony is over. They used to depart and meet again to take food. But it was of no special character, entirely harmless. He says, I don't know what we're doing. These people aren't criminals. They don't do anything wrong. They just meet early in the morning, probably to hide from people. They meet before sunup, and they get lessons about how you shouldn't commit adultery, and you shouldn't steal, and you shouldn't lie. And they all say this is the way of life they want to live, and they sing some songs to this Christ, and then they have a potluck. Sort of like us today. And he says, so why in the world am I supposed to persecute these people? So Trajan sends a letter back to the emperor, and he says, well, to tell you the truth, I'm not sure why either. Oh, there's another thing that Pliny writes. He says, so I took two deaconesses. I took two women who seemed to be leaders. They called them deaconesses. And I tortured them. And I tortured them and tortured them and tortured them. And they won't admit to anything. They haven't done anything wrong. They don't even seem to be bad citizens. So why am I to kill them? So Trajan sits back and says, here's what to do. He says, first of all, don't hunt them down. Let them alone. Now, if somebody brings a Christian before you, you have to make a judgment. So basically, you try to get them to recant. Try to get them to say, oh, okay, just here, eat a piece of pork or here. Just do it. Here's what they try to do. Do one sacrifice to one other god, and we'll let you go. Some of the Roman governors did all these things. Okay, just do this, and we'll pretend you're not a Christian. But they found they wouldn't do it. And so he says, look, you know, if they bring before you and someone says, my neighbor's a Christian, I brought them here, and you know, they're an arsonist and all this, well, you're going to have to try them. But don't go hunt them down. And it's very interesting. Trajan says, and if someone brings an anonymous accusation, do not bring it to court. In other words, this is the way of getting your neighbor. Sending an anonymous accusation that my neighbor is a Christian. And Trajan said, don't do that. If it's anonymous, say, I'm sorry, we don't take anonymous accusations in a Roman court. So Trajan's sort of like, just leave him alone. So you see, you have different approaches from different emperors. And I, you know, plenty of years, like, I can't even figure out why we're doing this. And he thought it was important enough to send a letter to the emperor about it. I want you to take your book and turn to page number 48. Once again, everybody has one, right? 48. Roman emperors in the early church. So in the time period we're covering, these are most of the emperors that are very important. Of course, we have Julius Caesar and Augustus. We've talked about them. Caligula, I mentioned him. Tiberius, by the way, was the emperor when Jesus was crucified. Augustus was the emperor. He died. And then Tiberius was the emperor. Caligula, who was crazy. Claudius, who pretended to be crazy. Nero, who was crazy. You have three emperors that ruled only a couple months each. Titus persecuted the Jews. He was the one who destroyed Jerusalem. I say he persecuted them. They revolted. I mean, they tried to overthrow the empire. You have Trajan down here. You'll see Trajan. Well, he did persecute the Jews, but he tried to be fair about it. I mean, not the Jews, but the Christians. Now, you're going to see a shift as we go on here. They're still persecuting the Jews, but the shift goes from the Jews to the Christians because they end up destroying the Jews as a nation. In 70 AD, they destroyed Jerusalem, but Judea still exists. You have Hadrian, who persecuted Christians, Antoninus Pius, who persecuted Christians, Marcus Aurelius, who was, once again, I said, if you ever watched the movie Gladiator, which isn't real historically correct, but, you know, except the battle scene with the Germans, that one was correct. Marcus Aurelius, he persecuted Christians. So Christians receive this periodic persecution that makes them, it drives them underground, and it separates them even more. So you may end up in a large city like Rome with eight different Christian churches, and they don't even associate with each other, and all eight of them are developing differently, just like the seven churches in Asia Minor. They're all developing differently. Oh, that's it. End of round one. Okay, that gets us good, because that takes us right up to the Bar Kokhba revolt, which is the destruction of Judea by the Romans. So that's what we'll pick up.